the reading that we heard today from Jesus, or about Jesus. He and his disciples have crossed the sea again. Like Mark likes to track how many times they crossed the sea. And they made their way to the Gerasenes, or Gadarenes. It has a couple of different names, just because why be clear? And it was decidedly Gentile territory, so not Jewish, and ultimately pagan in the technical sense, like the Greco-Roman pagan pantheon. And when they arrived at the shore, they encountered this guy who is naked, screaming, and he's known as the Gerasenes demoniac. He was demonized in some way, and it's a really dramatic moment. And Jesus speaks to the demons, and he finds out that their name is Legion because they are many, and so he casts them to the herd of pigs, and the pigs go into the water, and then that, of course, catches some attention, and the townspeople approach Jesus and his friends and this guy, and they know this guy because he's been a menace for many years, and he's just kind of there in his right mind having a conversation. Now, rather than being excited about this, they freak out, and I don't blame them for it, because this guy, Jesus, whoever he is, has some kind of enormous power. Now, we could talk, there are so many layers to that, but we're not going to talk about any of them, except to say that then this guy begs Jesus and his disciples to because he wants to join them. He begs them to take him on. And Jesus says, no, return to your city. In other words, you've been separated from community, from your own people for so long. Go back. Go back to them and tell them what God has done for you. And so we're told that he returns to roughly the kind of Decapolis area. Decapolis just means 10 cities. It's kind of a loose term, but it's decidedly Gentile territory. So he says, go tell everyone. And then Jesus and his buddies return back to more Jewish territory. They do a few things. And now this section, starting in Mark 7:24, so the beginning of this reading, really starts the beginning of what is known as Jesus' mission to the Gentiles. So again, non-Jewish people who probably have some kind of like, I mean, this is not the right term, but religious ideas, like closer to like the Greek and Roman pantheon, who would live in a very different ways and eat different things and have kind of a different story that they would tell about themselves. And so I think that actually will help explain some things. Because when they go to the region of Tyre and Sidon, which is pretty close to that general area, or close enough, it is Gentile territory, and they know who Jesus is, which is weird. They have no reason to. This is a group of people, broadly speaking, who are not Jewish, therefore they have no connection to the history of Israel. They are not waiting for the Messiah or anyone in particular to come and save them. They wouldn't even have necessarily a concept of being saved unless they were about to be eaten by a lion or something. And so the question then becomes, how do they know about Jesus? And I think within the narrative of Mark, the most obvious answer is that guy did his job. He talked and talked and talked, and word started to spread about this guy on the western side of Galilee, you know, where those strange people who look different and don't eat pork and stuff like that live. Because Jesus arrives and they seem very excited. And so this woman approaches her. And we're told by Mark that she's Greek, specifically of Syrophoenician descent. And that really means that she is descended from the ancient enemies of Israel, especially kind of on the northern side. So there would be kind of a reason for people who were Jewish to have some prejudice against this woman, and broadly speaking, her ethnicity or race or however you want to say it. So she approaches Jesus. Her daughter is ill. She's demonized in some way. And she implores Jesus for help. And Jesus' response at first seems really awkward. It's kind of one of those things that if we could go back and just say like, hey, Jesus, please don't say that. Like in 2,000 years, it's going to be really weird. Of course, then he'd look at you really funny and go, excuse me? Jesus. But when he says it's not right to take the bread from the children and feed it to the dogs, what he's saying ultimately is, look, I'm here for the people of Israel. Why would I take the things that I've come to give the people of Israel, the children of Israel, and feed it to the dogs? He calls her a dog. And first century Jewish people do not keep dogs as pets. To them, a dog is never, quite literally, never in Jewish literature, except for like one time in a book that nobody's ever heard of. It's not in the Bible. A dog is negative. Think like feral street dog or something like that. So it's pretty insulting. Or at least it could be read that way. The tricky thing is that Jesus has a history of helping Gentiles. And like I said, this is beginning a whole section where Jesus specifically is going and ministering to Gentiles. So Jesus clearly doesn't have a problem with that. So the question is, what does he mean? And I think her response helps us understand this a little bit better. First off, because it's funny. She says, yeah, but even the dogs eat what the children drop from the table. Now, the word dog there is not the feral street dog. It's like house dog. So think like little lap dog that people carry around in like those cases that are always shaking and terrified of everything. Something like that. I don't know. I'm a cat guy, so like you don't take those outside unless you want to have antibiotics, because they are sharp. Nonetheless, what she's saying here is, in a very witty way, look, if you help my daughter, you're not taking anything from the people of Israel. You're not taking anything from your Jewish brothers and sisters. You're just helping out a house dog. And then Jesus honors her. He says, because you said that, and your daughter as well. And in my own kind of imagination, he's laughing. And in the parallel account in Matthew, he's like, he actually honors her faith. And so I think the best way to understand this is that Jesus, as a really keen, insightful teacher, is making a provocative statement to draw something out of her. It might be maybe like me saying, and please, I'm not saying, oh, I'm kind of a teacher like Jesus. No, I'm not going there. Because I'm not. And also, things didn't end well for him. It would be like me saying, well, if I were God, this would be true. This is how things would be. And you would bristle at that. You'd go, what? How dare he? Wait, what does he mean by that? Oh, what he's saying is that the things that he wants about reality are different from the things that God wants about reality. And obviously, God's things win. It's kind of that style of rhetoric. He's drawing something out of her, which means that he's approaching her from a position of intense respect. And she is responding with wit and courage and also pretty intense humility. Um, And she seems to understand things that, at least at this point, the disciples don't. And so then Jesus, he goes sailing again, and they end up closer to the Decapolis region. Again, mostly Gentiles. There would be like some small Jewish communities there. But I think we're securely in Gentile territory. And again, word is spreading about this guy, this Jewish miracle worker. And so there are plenty of strange things about this moment, but Mark gives us some actual details about the actions of Jesus while he heals this man. It says that he's deaf and he's got some kind of speech impediment, which somebody who's a speech pathologist last service said, well, of course, because if you're deaf, you're going to have a hard time speaking. Okay, sure, I don't have that training. And the word there, like you, or the language there used to describe his speech is a very strange word. It's very rare. It only occurs once in the New Testament. And in the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, which is actually quite ancient, it's also used in the reading that we heard today from the prophet Isaiah about something happening, God acting, and people who could not speak suddenly can. There, he seems to be clearly, he's got that moment in mind. But nevertheless, they bring this guy to Jesus. And Jesus, of course, takes him and hides. Now, when Jesus first encountered that woman, he was trying to hide, but he couldn't. And he takes this guy, and it's like, well, let's go down an alley. Let's go away from the people. And that has led to constant speculation and scholarly work trying to figure out why Jesus is always trying to keep things under wraps. And there's a few theories. I think the best one is that Jesus is trying to keep things from heating up faster than they need to. Because once the Roman authorities who are trying to keep this place under control, this whole region is known to be a hotbed of revolution, wind of this guy who has this big following, there are miracles associated, and he's known and popular among the people, they know that they may have a threat and they're going to have to act. And Jesus knows that that's coming, but he has things to do before that. So that's, I think, why he's trying to, like, keep it on the down low. Which was, of course, a total failure. So Jesus, this guy is brought to Jesus. He puts his fingers in his ears. I don't know why. And then he spits and touches his tongue. Man, like, people say, like, the Bible's weird, and it's like, dude, you guys have no idea. There's a lot of, like, we don't know why, and at least from my modern sensibility, that's disgusting. Like, I have leukemia, and if you approached me and said, hey, I can cure you your leukemia, first I gotta spit, and then hold out your tongue, I'd say, you know, I'm good. My body is more or less adapting to the oral chemo. Like, I can manage the side effects. You stay over there. Now, we don't, like I said, we don't exactly know what's happening. But there is some thought, both in the Greek world and in the Jewish world, that saliva can have, like, some kind of healing property. More so in the Jewish world, it was said that the saliva of a firstborn son could be particularly potent, which is disgusting. I am the firstborn son, so for the right price, I am willing to spit in a cup. Actually, no, I would just throw it at you. Not the spit, but the cup, and say, all right, you stay over there. It's just weird. Like, these are important reminders that we're dealing with a culture that's very different from ours. I think, at the very least, Jesus may be mimicking things that the culture would have expected, but I don't know. Some things we just have to leave as a mystery. So Jesus, you know, does all of that, ephatha, and he is able to speak plainly. Now, there are many things that we can say here. Jesus is healer. Jesus is greater than whatever evil forces that are at work among us. Jesus is compassionate. Jesus breaks down barriers because as a Jewish man, he should not be interacting with a Gentile woman because she's a woman and she's Gentile. Those are cultural values, and Jesus has no problem just obliterating them. There's a lot that we can say there. Jesus crosses the boundaries of ethnicity and race. And that's something that the Christian church, over the millennia of our existence, we have not always gotten right. In fact, there are many examples where we've gotten that very, very wrong. But given the long arc of our existence, we have tended to tear down those barriers. Now, again, are there counterexamples? Absolutely. Our brothers and sisters in Christ have done terrible things. But Christian societies, given a long enough period of time, have tended to address racial issues, ethnic issues. But I don't want to go there today. Because there was a theme among both of these encounters that I think is it really caught my attention. The woman who approached Jesus when he had said it's not right to feed the food for the children to the dogs, she could have said, "Well, I never. That's terrible. Who are you? What are you saying?" And then wandered off. But not only did she have this insight and this wit, but she had humility to work on that premise. And respond to Jesus out of that humility. Jesus himself shows immense humility. He was a humble man, and one of the things among many that we can take from Mark's particular theme of secrecy is that Jesus doesn't feel the need for attention as he is quite literally changing the world. I mean, if you or I could perform miracles, would we keep it a secret? I wouldn't. And then as the crowd takes this man, this who can't hear and can't speak well, to Jesus, they're begging him. If you are begging somebody, you are not in control of that situation, and you are literally throwing yourself at the mercy of whomever you are begging from. That's humility. And the reason why I think that's important is it tends to run very counter to the way our culture thinks about these things. Imagine these scenarios in the modern world. We tend to be pretty entitled. Like if Jesus were there, and he was doing whatever he was doing, if we had ailments, if we were sick, if we were injured, if we had other things that needed deep healing, like within our hearts, within our minds, we had fractured relationships that we were desperate to bring healing to. I think culturally, we would approach Jesus with the sense of, well, of course he would help me. Why wouldn't he? And there's a sense where that can be a little dangerous. It's entitlement. It encourages us to be maybe a little bit demanding. Like in our prayer life, when we approach God because we are desperate for and in need, do we approach God as though he were a vending machine? Like, God, I need this, I need this, I need this. And also, I'd love to have this. And those things can all be really, really good. Or they could be legitimate needs. But what's our expectation? I think that's a major blind spot within our culture, this sense of entitlement, like we are owed something because we exist. And I don't see that in these two encounters with Jesus. Instead, I see people who are desperate, but also recognize that they are not in control of this situation, and this man in front of them is going to do whatever he wants to do. Now, they are at that point unaware of where this story is going. Because Jesus, as he goes and makes his way to Jerusalem, and he is executed by the Roman authorities at the manipulation of the temple elite, dies not just for Israel, but in a shocking revelation, he actually dies for the sake of humanity. And even more shocking, he defeats death, and it inaugurates this new moment in history where later Christians will say, like, there's no racial, ethnic division, there's no, like God is actually, has removed that separation. God is, we are now no longer disconnected from ourselves, we are also no longer disconnected from God, because our sin, our tendency to destroy ourselves and those around us has died with Jesus. And that's where we're headed. But I think there's something to be said about the humility in this moment that we see amongst this woman and this man. She's willing to say, you're right, I'm not owed anything, but I'll eat the scraps from the table. The people who bring this man to be healed by Jesus are willing to beg. And I think this suggests something that is very important to understand about the way of Jesus. It's that we have nothing to offer him. There's nothing that this woman has, or this blind, or this deaf and more or less mute, this guy who can't speak. He has nothing to offer Jesus either. And they recognize that, and their humility leads them to incredible things. And in the same way, there's nothing we really have to offer God that he needs. Jesus doesn't need our loyalty. Jesus doesn't need our work. He doesn't need the good things that we think we have to offer. And in fact, convincing ourselves that we have good and wonderful things to offer God probably makes things worse. Because then we feel like we are owed things. Well, I've done this for God. Why wouldn't he do that for me? I've served God in the church for my whole life, and yet now I'm sick. Why? How dare he? Or I've done these things for God. I've taught 10,000 Bible studies, and yet my marriage is falling apart. Why would he do that? The reality is that anything we might have to offer God is ash. And in that reality, or I should say, in that humility, something else opens up. Because if that is true, and I believe it is, that we have nothing to offer God that he does not have or need, then the gifts that he has given us are exactly that. The blessings that he has bestowed on us and given in our lives are completely and wholly undeserved. They come without contingencies. They come without expectations. They are not dependent on our ability or lack thereof to love God, ourselves, or other people, because that love embedded in those blessings and gifts originates with God and depends solely and entirely on him. Jesus doesn't come to the earth so that you can live your best self. Jesus comes to rescue you in spite of yourself, which means that you are free from the need to prove yourself, to be a certain thing, to be a certain way. Because what Jesus has to offer has nothing to do with that, and has everything to do with the love he has for us. Amen. I invite you to rise as you are able.